HPPodCraft.com.
A scream rang from the lookout in the bows. Thrusting Belit aside, Conan bounded up, his sword a long silver glitter in the moonlight, his hair bristling at what he saw. The black warrior dangled above the deck, supported by what seemed a dark, pliant tree trunk arching over the rail. Then he realized that it was a gigantic serpent, which had writhed its glistening length up the side of the bow and gripped the luckless warrior in its jaws. Its dripping scales shone leprously in the moonlight as it reared its form high above the deck, while the stricken man screamed and writhed like a mouse in the fangs of a python. Conan rushed into the bows, and swinging his great sword, hewed nearly through the giant trunk, which was thicker than a man's body. Blood drenched the rails as the dying monster swayed far out, still gripping its victim, and sank into the river, coil by coil, lashing the water to bloody foam, in which man and reptile vanished together.
I can't tell you how many nights out on Kohanga ended up the exact same way. Sometimes the snake got your buddy, sometimes the snake got you.
Yeah, or sometimes, like here, the man and reptile vanished together and then turned up all coked out of their minds at 4 a.m., you know, bruised up because they tried to break into an Arby's. Very relatable scenario. Speaking of relatable, not all of the metaphors in that paragraph are winners. You know, some are. The monster seemed a dark, pliant tree trunk arching over the rail. Okay, that's cool. Yeah. The giant trunk, which was thicker than a man's body. So both of these are giving me a sense of the size and character, but then it says, the stricken man screamed and writhed like a mouse in the fangs of a python. And that's a straight up snake to snake comparison. The scream sounded like this exact scenario, except smaller, and I doubt you've ever witnessed it. Because, I don't know what a snake... It's not like there's a lot of explicit snake-mouse violence on the news or in the movies. You know, I don't know what a... I'll never know what that scream sounded like. And I was actually really troubled by this, so I asked our reader today, Joshua Bentley, joining us once again. I said, hey, man, if you could just maybe interpret that scream for us, I'd appreciate it. And here's what I got.
Snake! Get... Snake, geez, stop! Gross! I don't like that, Snake! Stop it! No more, Snake! No!
Wow. So, yeah, there you go. This is why you subscribe, folks. We take this elevated material and we translate it for the common man. Yeah, if I were ever to do a special edition or update of the story, I think I would just transcribe everything Josh said there. The soldier screamed, and then it would just be that. And that's the only thing I'd really update, because the racial attitudes in the story, they really hold up. Just like the title of this podcast, it's the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. Hey, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here at Patreon and, of course, HPPodCraft.com.
It's been a week since we talked about this story. Could you refresh me?
Yes, the story so far. Conan has hooked up with his pirate queen, Belit, and they've been pirating for a while? Not very specific.
As long as it takes to get famous.
And she's come up with an idea to go up this river that goes into a jungle to find a lost city which is supposed to have untold riches. Conan is like, sure, whatever.
Yeah, he's kind of outsourced this decision-making to Belit, which is maybe not the best idea, but I get it. I mean, Belit gets a lot of support from people who just don't want to figure out what to do for dinner. That's like half of her crew.
So on the first night up the river, a giant snake kills one of the crewmen. Thereafter, Conan kept the lookout watch himself.
Snake watch nights.
As dawn comes, they see a city in the jungle, but it's a ghost town. Ruins overgrown with vegetation. There's a marble pyramid in the center with a slim column. And at the top sits what they think is a statue, but then it moves and it flies. It is a winged ape.
Yes, I love this. Normally, you know, when you have people describe something this way, because they all comment on what they think this thing is before it takes off. Usually when you do that, it's to express how strange something is. Like, famously, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. Mm-hmm. That last clause is a correction. You know, no, it's not either of these things that your human brain can conceive. It's actually a man who can fly. Mm-hmm. But in a mythos story, it would be more like, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a bird plane. The answer is always all of the above. Because it happens here. One guy says, I think that's a bird. The other guy says, it's a monster bat. Belit says, I think it's an ape. And then it flies off and they're like, oh, it's a monster bird bat ape. We were all wrong. And right.
So the wise shaman of the crew, Nyaga, says that the place is haunted and they should leave. Of course, Belit does not listen.
Does Nyaga mean it's haunted on top of the monster bird bat ape? Or is it, and maybe this is a stupid question, but is it the ghost of a monster bird bat ape?
I don't know.
I think he's just saying this place ain't good. It might be haunted. There's a flying ape. There's probably a lot of wrong things here. Let's leave.
Belit's not superstitious, though. So she believes in the supernatural power of love.
Just like Huey Lewis.
Just like Huey Lewis, but haunting's dumb. Also like Huey Lewis.
So they go into the city and they find this ancient altar that is still stained with blood some thousands of years after the fact. This was a temple of the old ones. But who were the old ones? Demanded Conan. Not even in legendary is the city mentioned, but look at the handholds on either end of the altar. Priests often conceal their treasures beneath their altars. Or if you lay hold and see if you can lift it. So Conan and some guys, they try and move the altar, but Belit tells Conan that she saw a snake and asks him to go get it. After he walks away, another guy takes his place.
She yells, there's a snake, and if you can't imagine what it looks like, think of a smaller snake. So you can kind of tell that she's making it up with that bad comparison.
Yes, because some kind of booby trap is sprung and the wall tumbles and the men pushing the altar are crushed. Belit tells Conan secretly there was no snake, but she suspected it might be booby trapped.
Just when you thought Belit was a good person.
I never thought that.
Well, you know, if you were to give Conan some grief about this for following somebody like this, I would bet philosopher Conan that he is in this story that he might say, well, don't civilized people do this all the time? She made a plan, drafted some soldiers, but when there was danger, she pulled Conan.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can't. No, the draft doesn't apply to him. He's got panther thighs. He can't go. She's a pirate, but if you add a few more ships, it's a navy is all I'm saying. Queen is a pretty good title for her. This is sort of what governments do.
Sure. They clear away the rubble and find a way into a crypt. In the crypt, they find crazy treasure. Undreamable wealth lay before the eyes of the gaping pirates. Diamonds, rubies, bloodstones, sapphires, turquoises, moonstones, opals, emeralds, amethysts, unknown gems that shone like the eyes of evil women.
Again, very easily understandable reference. There probably is something to that thing that we talked about in the last episode with Howard making her a Shemite, and then she also is craving treasure. Because even here it says, the Shemite soul finds a bright drunkenness and riches and material splendor. So it's something that's particular to her people. But as we learned from Beowulf, all peoples are pretty much addicted to treasure.
It's true.
You know, so it's hard to say, but...
Belit finds a necklace with red stones and she puts it on. She yells at the men to start loading up the treasure. However, one of them notices the winged ape flying away from their ship. Of course, their ship was left unguarded. Conan decides he's going to run back and see if it did anything. Belit seems too busy with the treasure to care.
They were stupid to leave that ship unguarded, but I have to admit, it kind of surprised me too that the ape didn't just attack them. It went over to look, kind of have a look at the ship first. The sailors say the devil ape has been investigating the ship. Conan kind of smirks and says, you mean an appraisal? And Belit doesn't laugh. So you know she's obsessed with the treasure.
You know, that's funny, Chad, that's not in my copy of the story.
No?
No, the appraisal is not here.
Yeah, it's an alternate title of the story, actually.
Appraisal?
Appraisal. I don't know. I think it works.
So Conan comes back and says that the ape destroyed their water stores. They have to find water, and they can't drink from the river because it's polluted and evil and gross for whatever reason. Conan takes some men and goes into the jungle to try and find fresh water.
That's when you find out the ape's real plan. He's got a lemonade stand.
As they search, Conan thinks that they are being followed, and he tells the men to go ahead of him, and he's going to hang back and try and catch the sneak. As he waits, he smells something, and he turns and sees a black flower growing behind him, and he realizes that one of them has just touched his arm and that it actually moved, though no wind had blown. It's a black lotus, and its juice is death, but the smell produces dream-haunted slumber. Conan tries to yell out to his mates, but he can't, and he passes out.
The horror in the jungle is the next chapter, and this is another one of those signature Robert E. Howard dream-questing to the past kind of things that he likes to do, that ancestral memory kind of thing. That black lotus thing just there kind of... Yesterday, I have an aloe vera plant, and I cut off one of the leaves... And the stuff that came out of it smelled like chicken noodle soup. Really freaked me out.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It was like yellowish colored and it smelled exactly like chicken noodle soup. I didn't look up if that's normal or not. I just figured I'd throw that out there. Maybe somebody can tell me if I should be worried.
Good crowdsourcing. He finds himself in a tripped out version of the city where there are winged men walking around. He says they're alien but heroic, making man look like an ape by comparison. The civilization has lasted for millions of years. Millions, not thousands or hundreds of thousands, millions of years. But then there was a change. The magnetic poles shifted and the land faced cataclysm. Earthquakes hit and volcanoes erupted. The water became tainted and many of these people died. But those who didn't die changed. And after generations, they became more bestial.
They who had been winged gods became pinion demons, with all that remained of their ancestors' vast knowledge distorted and perverted and twisted into ghastly paths. As they had risen higher than mankind might dream, so they sank lower than man's maddest nightmares reach. They died fast by cannibalism and horrible feuds fought out in the murk of the midnight jungle. And at last, only a single shape lurked, a stunted, abhorrent perversion of nature.
I feel like that excerpt's going to be used for a documentary about Pitch Black Manor sometime in the future.
God, I hope not.
Yeah, well, it's got a real VH1 Behind the Music feel to it.
They had risen higher than mankind might dream and sank lower than man's maddest nightmares. Horrible feuds.
Cannibalism.
Cannibalism.
Eventually, some of the men of Stygia came to this place. Weary, they rested and they slept. And as they slept, a hideous shape crept red-eyed from the shadows and performed weird and awful rites about and above each sleeper. The moon went down and the eyes of the necromancer were red jewels set in the ebony of night. When dawn spread its white veil over the river, there were no men to be seen, only a hairy winged horror that squatted in the center of a ring of 50 great spotted hyenas that pointed quivering muzzles to the ghastly sky and howled like souls in hell.
Whew.
Man, I can see why heavy metal bands love this stuff.
This is responsible for the whole hyena rock genre, right?
This story, that line, really.
Yeah.
Then came more visions of people coming to the ruins only to find death and madness at the hands of these supernatural horrors until finally he sees himself on the pirate ship, the Tigris, and he at that point knows he's dreaming.
Right. It's all catching up to where he is in the present moment. I often get a little annoyed when stories cut away to backstory, but if it's prehistoric in scope like this, that's pretty cool.
I like it. He can see his men waiting in the jungle for him. Then they're attacked by a thing from above, and he tries to wake himself up, but he can't. He's still asleep because of this black lotus. And then it says, with a savage effort, he broke the unseen bonds which held him in his dreams and started upright. He fights himself awake. Conan!
That is the toughest thing he's ever done. That's so awesome.
He sees a hyena footprint and he yells for his guys, but there's silence. He freaks out because he's not sure how long he's been asleep. He follows his men's tracks and he finds the scene that he saw in his vision, but there's no men there, only spears and shields. He finds tracks going off in different directions, and then Conan runs through the jungle to a cliff's edge, and then he catches sight of something. It's Nagora, and he has gone insane and attacks Conan. The writing in this particular section is super racist, so I'm just going to gloss over it.
It's pretty gross.
Conan sees that there is no saving this guy and sadly runs him through with his sword. Conan looks over the edge and he sees that the others have smashed upon the rocks. So basically this flying thing came, scared them, and they ran and ran themselves through the jungle, and there was a cliff that they didn't see, and then they fell to their death.
Mm-hmm.
Conan runs off back to the ship, finding it still at the rotting wharf, but all the men there are dead and there are footprints of hyenas all about.
Have we had hyena men on the show before in any kind?
Well, we did in that story, The Drone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just recently.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah. I feel like maybe even before then, because I know at some point I think we've talked about how weird hyenas are.
Yeah.
But I guess that could have come about for any number of reasons.
Because they're strange. I guess more closely related to cats than to dogs.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's a cat. It's a dog. Nope, cat dog. It's confusing because people think they're hermaphroditic because the female hyena is the more aggressive of the two. And also, yeah, it has like three times the testosterone as the males. And then also, for reasons that science doesn't really understand, the clitoris in the female is gigantic.
Oh, so it looks like a penis.
Exactly. So that's why people get confused by it, because it looks like the females have both organs.
So on the deck of the ship, speechless, the Cimmerian looked on the queen of the Black Coast as she hung from the yardarm of her own galley. Between the yard and her white throat stretched a line of crimson clots that shone like blood in the gray light.
That's that necklace, right? That she loved so much. Yet another example of monsters hating greed. We've said it before, people think it's sex and drugs or going against God, but the number one thing that seems to get you killed by monsters is greed, hands down. That's what does it. And I was thinking about it. This story was published in 1934, and it probably wouldn't escape the notice of the readers at that time that it shares a lot with King Kong, which came out in 1933, mm-hmm. as well as a sequel. I think they made the Son of Kong movie right away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you've got the jungle plundering, you've got the giant ape, you've got the ancient civilization, even the regal reference in both titles, you know, Queen of the Black Coast, King Kong. Right. And both are essentially metaphorical punishments for greed. And so this is, I'm thinking of it more, I mean, this is right in the middle of the Great Depression. And so I think you can see where some of this might be coming from, both King Kong and the story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Her pulling him aside and letting the little people get punished so that she can plunder, it was kind of what was happening in America, or where we were at that time as a result of that kind of plundering. And in 1934, all the pulps were folding. Howard pretty reliably published in this other Farnsworth Wright periodical called Oriental Tales, and that had folded. A bunch of them were going down. Weird Tales was going bi-monthly. And so he was watching his livelihood just get yanked away. This is only a few years before he killed himself. It's something that was, unfortunately, most of the people I know are going through right now, where their livelihoods are just disappearing. And every once in a while, something like what's happening now or the Great Depression happens, and it pulls the curtain aside, and we see the lie of civilization a little bit.
Sure.
The safeguards just aren't there that we were told were there. And I, you know, I think, and you go, wow, we've all been working for Belit because deciding what to make for dinner is hard. That's how they got us in. But for them, it was so they could plunder. And at the end of the day, I think the anger that motivates this Conan character is why I'm willing to wade through all sorts of small-minded bullshit from the author. In a lot of cases, he's accidentally fighting against some of his own prejudices, which I find interesting. But the character Conan is kind of bigger than the author, because you would be hard-pressed to find a more naked example of that kind of hostility in so many ways.
He does wear chainmail.
That's true. That's true. He does. Sometimes he's got a helmet on. But I was just having a conversation about this with a friend the other day, because there was a radio ad for the new Perry Mason show on HBO. And right away it says, when are you going to play by the rules, Perry? Because you can't have a career-based show without having a main character that doesn't play by the rules.
Sure.
You know, George Clooney's a pediatrician who doesn't play by the rules. So many shows. It's a cop who doesn't play by the rules. Miss Maisel, you know, it's a comedian who doesn't play by the rules. That's because we love our heroes to push back against society, but all of those characters are chafing against it. They're trying to change the unjust rules, but Conan just splits the judge's skull. You can't really get more direct than that. He burns the whole thing down.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's eternally attractive about the character. It's like a more honest treatment of what we're all really looking for in some of these stories. Anyway, that's my little speech about it. That gets us into the next chapter, The Attack from the Air.
Belit lies there dead, with her treasure heaped around her, wrapped in Conan's scarlet cloak. Night has fallen, and Conan has gone to the pyramid to face whatever the ruins will throw at him.
He just tosses the treasure into the river. He's angry about it. He doesn't care.
Conan wonders why he was spared, and why, whatever it is, decided to put Belit up on display. Perhaps it was saving him for last, his choicest victim? You know, Conan does not have any self-image issues.
No. It'd be funny if he did. Is he saving me for last just because I'm fat?
So he sits with a bow and a big pile of arrows. Flying creature, of course, might be difficult to deal with a sword.
Who likes archery now, Conan? That was ironic, right?
Seems Conan's pretty into it.
That's the character growth in the story.
There you go. He does have some growth. So Conan then notices dark shapes moving in the trees. There are 20 hyenas. Conan just shoots one with an arrow, and then the rest realize, okay, it's on. On they came, and like a rain of death among them fell the arrows of the Cimmerian, driven with all the force and accuracy of steely thews backed by a hate hot as the slag heaps of hell.
That's the metaphor game I'm looking for. You can't trot stuff like that out and then have tiny snake metaphors earlier.
You know,
it's got to be slag heaps of hell all the time.
So less than half of them make it to the pyramid, but these things were no normal hyenas. They were bigger and had an aura of evil. By what godless alchemy these beings had been brought into existence, he could not guess, but he knew he faced diabolism blacker than the well of Skellos. So one of them jumps at Conan, but he lets an arrow off into the beast and it falls dead. The rest are on Conan as he picks up his sword.
Two of them attack him at once, and he rips open one's throat. The other, he breaks its hind leg and it lets out a little human cry.
The rest attack brutally, but Conan is able to dispatch them. And then he hears the sounds of beating wings above him. But instead of being attacked from above, the pyramid rumbles under his feet and the pyramid collapses and a column almost falls on him, but he jumps away. Unfortunately, stone is falling all over the place, and a huge piece of stone pins him to the ground.
Does the ape have earthquake powers?
I guess so.
Yeah.
It's magical. Obviously, the ape is what turned these men into
hyenas.
Hyena monsters.
Yeah. So this is the necromancer from the...
The ape is... The winged ape is the necromancer, or the degenerate demonic descendant of the winged people of this place.
Yeah.
So he's got some kind of magic powers. He's intelligent. Seeing the opportunity, the winged thing attacks Conan.
It says, it was a thing neither man, beast, nor devil, imbued with characteristics subhuman, as well as characteristics superhuman. So if you take the average, he's human. So I don't, you know.
Yeah, that's, you got a good
doesn't
point
seem
there.
So monstrous to me.
Conan can't reach his sword, so he moves to unpin himself, but he realizes he does not have enough time. The beast is going to kill him. But
in one mad instant, she was there, a tense white shape, vibrant with love, fierce as a she panther's. The dazed Cimmerian saw between him and the onrushing death, her lithe figure shimmering like ivory beneath the moon. He saw the blaze of her dark eyes, the thick cluster of her burnished hair. Her bosom heaved, her red lips were parted. She cried out sharp and ringing as the ring of steel as she thrust at the winged monster's breast. Belit! Screamed Conan. She flashed a quick glance at him, and in her dark eyes he saw her love flaming, a naked elemental thing of raw fire and molten lava. Then she was gone, and the Cimmerian saw only the winged fiend which had staggered back in unwonted fear, arms lifted as if to fend off attack.
Belit did it?
She did.
Her love was so good that she came back to help him in ghost form.
You know, this is really strange, because she's a terrible...
Sorry, just occurred to me. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
This is really strange because she is a terrible human being.
Yeah.
Like, she's a pirate. She's a murdering pirate, and she murders her own people to gain wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, she actually has a love for Conan that is so strong that she comes back from the dead to help him.
You ever been loved by a monster? It's intense.
So this distraction is all Conan needs, and he is able to free himself.
The thews started out like cords on his forearms as he swung his great sword. Just above the hips, it caught the hurtling shape, and the knotted legs fell one way, the torso another, as the blade sheared clear through its hairy body.
Oof. Sorry you had to split.
Hey, come over here. These monsters are half off. He tried to make a monkey out of me, and I made two monkeys out of him. Cram!
Oh, wow.
That's what happened.
That was pure joy. Bless you, sir. So the bodies of the hyenas were replaced by that of men, the men of Stygia. So remember that vision he had where those Stygian men came and they got turned into... So they've been there for thousands of years or hundreds of years. We don't know. But they quickly turn to dust. Conan goes to the galley and cuts it free. The ship floats down the river. Yeah. We end with Conan looking out at the sea from a white sand beach, leaning on his great sword.
Belit had been of the sea. She had lent it splendor and allure. Without her, it rolled barren, dreary, and desolate waste from pole to pole. She belonged to the sea. To its everlasting mystery, he returned her. He could do no more. For himself, its glittering blue splendor was more repellent than the leafy fronds which rustled and whispered behind him of vast, mysterious wilds beyond them, and into which he must plunge. So passed the Queen of the Black Coast, and leaning on his red-stained sword, Conan stood silently until the red glow had faded far out in the blue hazes, and the dawn splashed its rose and gold over the ocean.
That is the end of the story.
That's it. Still one of my favorite Conans. A little bit of an explanation why he's landlocked in most of his adventures. All the romance of the ocean went out with Belit.
You remember the Conan film with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the first one?
Yeah, love it.
This story seems to at least partially influence that script. The character was called Valeria in that movie, but she dies and then in the end of the movie comes back as a ghost to kind of help Conan.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's also the giant snake. The similarity, I'm sure that John Milius actually write that as well. I think he was Oh, no, it was, well, one of the versions of it was Oliver Stone.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
remember?
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about
I think, like,
before,
normal,
yeah.
The script probably went through a few hands, but definitely this is cited by, at some point. These guys knew this story, and Valeria was the bleat figure, and they pulled some plot points from it, too.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, one complaint about that movie is that it's not necessarily rooted in the Robert E. Howard stories, but here we see that it kind of is.
Yeah.
That's the best Conan movie. I mean, there's...
Oh, yeah.
Hands down.
I couldn't sit through that Jason Momoa one.
How can
Conan be boring?
He's a great actor. Good casting. Yeah. Looks like Conan. Yeah,
but
I know.
But it was just... I think it's the script. I mean, Conan's got to be doing Conan stuff all the time. He's Conan.
Yeah.
And I think there was a bunch of talking that was going on that I'm like, Conan doesn't talk like this. Conan is a man of action.
Yeah, you so don't need a complicated plot.
No.
Or anything like that. I think that thematically, you really have to be dealing with some of the things we were talking about over the course of the story, which is a barbarian in a civilized world kind of pointing out that civilization isn't so civilized. You don't need deceptions and political maneuvering and things like that. That's enough of a complicated thing to deal with.
Oh, for sure.
And you deal with it just by throwing this guy like a hand grenade into the middle of these scenarios. It's just like I was saying. It kind of lays bare all of the untruths right away.
Yeah.
Like that judge saying, no, you have to tell me the law compels you. And he goes, no, I don't. And he proved it. I want to thank our reader, Joshua Bentley. Make sure to check out his new album, Monster Classics, dropping later this month. I'm a big fan. I was reading in the fan club forums about these guys, and the guitarist, Lyle Erickson, apparently likes a Solomon Kane story called Skulls in the Stars. So we're going to tackle that one next week.
Oh.
Apparently a ghost gets punched in the story.
Yes!
Physically punched, that's what Lyle's saying, so we'll have to see if that's true. You know what is true, though? My love for our patrons.
I can't even begin to tell you how much I love those guys.
Why don't we begin right now by naming some of them?
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, I'm going to start with Carol Leibiger.
I'd like to thank Literary Octopus.
I would like to thank Dan Bethel.
Thank you, Taylor Petty.
Craig Finzeth, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Vern Etcher.
I'd like to thank Natalie West 3.
I'd like to thank Alan Trahan.
Claire Armstrong, thank you so much.
And thank you, Dave Mackin.
You all are wonderful. We're going to be coming back, like I said, with some Solomon Kane, which I don't... We haven't done any Solomon Kane on here yet.
I don't think we've done a Solomon Kane story yet on this. So, yeah, we're going to be breaking some new ground.
Breaking some new ground here in Thulai. Hope you enjoyed the show. More coming. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lank, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.